So I think it's time to start this morning's Dhamma talk. And I do prefer to give talks on how to meditate and understand what happens when you meditate more than tell you what you're going to find when you get there, simply because it's really important that you experience these things for yourself. And so about this time on a retreat, I usually like to talk about the subject of nimittas. Some of you have experienced some of those, some of you haven't. And those of you who haven't experienced the nimittas yet, you think, oh my goodness, why do we talk about these things? They're way ahead of me. I will never be able to do these things. But the point is that you'd be surprised. That sometimes you're meditating and you don't expect anything and these incredible lights actually appear in your mind and you want to find out exactly what they are and how to deal with them. So this whole subject of nimittas is really important. And for those of you who would ask the question, avoiding a question this evening, well, did the Buddha talk about the nimittas? Or is this just coming from what we call the commentaries written by monks after the time of the Buddha? And the answer, of course, is of course the Buddha talked about these. And it's one whole sutta, one whole discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings, devoted to nimittas. And that's called the Upekalesa Sutta. The problem was, though, that the translator never actually translated the term as nimitta. And he actually translated it as that thing, which didn't really sort of help anybody. But if you look at the footnotes in the back, you say, oh yeah, that means nimitta. But what that meant, it sort of hid the fact that nimittas were really important in the path of meditation. And you can find it there, Upekalesa Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And look at the back, you see, yeah, the footnote. If you read it in Pali, it's obvious. It's the importance of the nimittas and the different problems you get when you have nimittas. But to give you the background to them, this is what happens when the five senses start to disappear. And then you become aware of the sixth sense, the mind. And many people ask, well, what is the mind? Where is the mind? You can have all sorts of theories about this, but the best thing is actually having direct experience of it. And how can you have direct experience of this thing we call the mind? In Pali, it's usually called the citta. And the only real way is to find a technique, a means, so the five senses can disappear, and so the sixth sense, what remains, can be manifest. And my simile was a simile of the emperor. There was an emperor who was very, very, very powerful. But no one knew what the emperor was, whether it was male or female, whether it was old or young, whether it was Sri Lankan or Western or Korean or Thai. No one had ever seen the emperor, because every time the emperor appeared in public, it was covered with five pieces of clothing. And those five pieces of clothing were boots. Boots which went halfway up to the thighs. And had pants, trousers, which covered the top of the boots and went way up to the waist. And a jacket which overlapped the top of the trousers and had sleeves which went way down to the wrists and a high neck. And he had gloves, or it had gloves, which overlapped the end of the sleeves. And lastly, a helmet which overlapped the top of the jacket. I don't know these things, but someone said, that is like Darth Vader in Star Wars. you can never see what actually this guy is. But this was before Darth Vader times when I did this simile, and that this emperor is always covered with those clothing, so you can't see even the colour of the skin or the gender or the age. No one knows what the emperor is, except the emperor's very, very powerful. So the only way to find out is you've got to take those five pieces of clothing off. Take off the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves, and the helmet, and then you know exactly what this emperor is. And that is a simile. The emperor obviously stands for the mind, the jitta, and the five pieces of clothing stand for seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch, the five senses. These five senses cover this thing we call the mind so completely, you never really can see it. So, what we do is we take off the five senses. We calm them down until they all disappear. We close our eyes, as I said. Close our eyes until it's not we're seeing the inside of our eyelids anymore. We're not seeing at all. The sense of sight has turned off. The trick, as I mentioned earlier, is stillness. When nothing moves, the brain turns off. The brain is only wired to notice things which change. So similar to a computer screen. If you don't click a mouse or press the screen somewhere, then after a while, it turns off. That's so similar to your brain. So because you're not seeing anything, after a while, the brain or the sight turns off. And smell, as long as nobody passes wind. If the smell stays the same, then smell turns off. Taste turns off. Hearing. It's one of the reasons why we try to make sure that people don't bang the doors. Because a sudden sound brings the sense of hearing back on. It turns it back on again. And you have to learn how to turn it off once more. So when hearing turns off, which it does do, after a while you're inside and you can't hear anything. And sometimes even the bell goes and you can't hear it. You're not asleep. You're perfectly alert and awake. And to preempt a question, when people ask, well, how do I know in meditation I was asleep or in deep meditation? You know, because deep meditations are full of powerful awareness and lots of happiness. And afterwards, you just got so much energy. If you come out afterwards, then that was sleep. So, but don't worry about sleepiness. That's not such a big problem. Restlessness is a problem. So, the hearing disappears. And one of the hardest things to get rid of is the body. The sense of physical touch. Now, there's a couple of reasons why the sense of physical touch and also the sense of hearing are the last to go. It's because that those are our alarm systems. It gives us a sense of security, at least we're hearing. So if anyone's going to sneak up behind us, we can hear them. Or even physical touch. If there's any problem here, we can actually feel it with our body and therefore react and save ourselves from injury or harm. So these are like security. So we have to have a lot of sense of trust and safety to be able to let these things go. It's one of the problems with actually getting into deep meditation. You have to trust you're in a safe place. Because otherwise, people, as I said, that guy who was in the army, they could pick you up, put you in the back of a car, and who knows where you may end up. You don't know anything which is going on. But that little sense of safety and security is important for you. You must also know that you are incredibly safe. Because especially if you get into these jhanas, when the five senses are really shut off, It's weird, but you do become invulnerable. You cannot be harmed. And the two stories I say about that, one is from the suttas, the Buddha's teachings, and the other one is actually from a monk I got to know, who's passed away now. And this story in the suttas is one of my favorites because it's weird, and I like weird stuff. But it also serves a purpose of giving you a sense of safety. This monk was in the forest meditating, obviously in a jhana, and he was so still that when villagers passed by collecting mushrooms or herbs, they couldn't see him breathing, and so they thought the monk had died. So, what did they do? Being devout Buddhists, they thought, we can't let this monk be eaten by jungle animals. We should give him a proper funeral. So they were in the forest anyway. They just collected some wood, which was hanging all around, and built a funeral pyre. And they respectfully put the monk on top. And then they lit the fire, and they did some chanting, whatever they knew anything would do in an emergency. And then they walked off, because the fire would do the rest of the work. It actually takes a lot of time to burn a body and a funeral pyre, so they couldn't wait for it to be burnt. No, it would be burned naturally now. So they went off to do their work. They're busy people. So they cremated the venerable. So they thought. Because the following morning, that monk walked into the village for alms food. And not even his robes were burnt or singed. And when the Buddha told that story, this is what happens. If you get into one of these deep meditations and they try to cremate you, they put you in a box and they shove you in the oven. The box will burn, but then when the guy, opens the oven door to collect the ashes, hi, me again. You can't get rid of me that easy. So that's actually in the suttas, but, was that just a myth? And there was this monk, is an Indonesian monk, I don't know if you ever met Sudama, but he passed away a few years ago. That's why I don't mind telling the stories. You keep a lot of this stuff quiet until a person dies, so he doesn't get into trouble by people always going up to him and thinking he's something special. So afterwards, when people die, we tell exactly what they were up to. But this monk, I met him, he was in Wat Bawan where I met him, and had a nice chat with him. He told me his story, that he was a Buddhist, but he wanted to become a hermit, going into the deep jungles in Java. That was the time when there were jungles in Java. They were all just developed these days. But anyway, went into the jungles, and found a nice quiet place, sat down to meditate. And this is how he described it, almost verbatim, because I was struck by just how we use different language. And if we know what we're talking about, we can understand. Yeah, that's a way that an Indonesian with not the best grasp of English could describe these things. He said he was sitting down there, getting very peaceful, and this big star came up. Huge, brilliant star. And he said, I always remember the way he said that, he merged into the star. He said he married the star. And after marrying the star, when he came out of this incredible, powerful meditation, it was actually days afterwards. Because he found that out from the villagers. And what he noticed when he came out was the area had changed. He hadn't been moved. Only what had happened, he checked with the villagers, there had been a big flood. And he'd been under a few feet of water for days. He'd been totally submerged. And didn't matter at all. He was perfectly okay. So, if ever there is a flood, if ever there is a fire, you just meditate and get in jhana. And when the fire is finished, you can get out and just go away. You don't need to have a fire bunker. Or you don't need... So, but you become invulnerable, and that's what he did. And so, but he was also, again, weird stories. But, you know, I got this. I never saw this myself, but there are some people you trust, and you ask him and ask him and ask him. He said, yeah, it's true. That he was actually teaching some meditation in Wat Bawan on a Saturday. And so I get lots of people go there to do meditation with him. And this one lady, who I knew really, really, really well, and she was a Mom Luang. That means a princess. And she told me that she was meditating there, just like you're meditating, and your eyes closed, you think something's going on, something weird's happening, you can feel it. And she opened her eyes, and that was the last time she went to meditate with this monk. Because she saw, and she said, absolutely real, no imagination. She said she saw these laser lights coming out of this monk's eyes into one of the meditators. This was not Hollywood. This was no special effects. This was real. Now, how cool is that? The monk with laser eyes, real ones. And the reason we don't say those stories until he dies, because if he was alive now, you'd all be going to see him. Show us your laser eyes. I want to see that. So anyway, that is a really amazing monk.
And so what was it?
Laser eyes.
Yeah, but why did he do that, or what happened?
No one asked him. You don't dare to ask a monk with those sorts of powers. He may laser you. Quite benign. But anyway, the main part of the story is just invulnerability. And the reason I say that is, you know, it's a nice thing to hear in a story, on a talk, so you don't get bored, but also to give you a sense of safety. You don't need to worry at all. You're perfectly safe. Otherwise, you tend to be too afraid of letting go of your five senses, which part of their function is to protect you from harm. So, you can let them go. And when those five senses do disappear, of course, then what comes up next? It is the only thing next, you're still aware, you're not unconscious, that is the thing we call the mind, the sixth sense. Taken off the other five clothes. That's my simile. The Buddha simile was the goldsmith trying to find out the properties of gold, has to purify the gold of impurities. Any other elements have to be removed from the gold, so you've just got 100% pure gold, and then you know its properties. That was a Buddha simile. And of course, how you do that is by becoming so peaceful, things vanish, so you can't hear anything. The bell goes, you can't hear it. This is a lovely old story, another old anecdote. This is from Wat Bapong time. This was the days, and I've mentioned this before, I was a disciple of Ajahn Chah, and think how lucky you were. Sometimes I thought, no, I was not lucky at all, because some of Ajahn Chah's talks would go on for hours, 5, 6, 7, 8, sometimes all night. And that wouldn't be so bad if they were really interesting. Any anecdotes or talks which you have now have been edited. So you just got the nuggets of gold and all the dross and the useless stuff has been edited out. You know, and it was worth it because every now and again you got this amazing jewel of the Dharma and it was worth hours waiting for. But this was one of those nights Ajahn Chah was going on and on and on, and there was a little novice at the temple. You know, they ordain novices. Sometimes it's like a social safety net when their parents can't look after them, or sometimes a parent dies, and so the monastery takes them in. Just in all Buddhist countries, they do that. And so this little novice was listening to the talk by Ajahn Chah, going on and on and on. And it's, you know, it's about 11, 12, 13 years of age, something like that. And it's all right for these big guys, these grown-ups. I'm a little novice. I need my sleep. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When's he going to stop? And that became like a mantra for him. When's he going to stop? Look at the clock. When's he going to stop? And that went on for an hour or two. When's he going to stop? And then this little novice had an insight. And this is sometimes what insights are. Just looking at a thing from the other way around. And then he thought, just one thought, when am I going to stop? The little novice thought. And the next thing he knew, he'd opened his eyes. It was dawn. All the monks had gone. And he just had the first really beautiful experience in meditation of his life. It would have been a jhana. He stopped. That's another word for letting go. Stop. And I always remember that story because it's also the story of Angulimala, when the Buddha told him, stop. And I always remember that whenever I go to some sort of appointment in town, I always, whenever I get to the crossroads and see stop sign, I always remember, wow, even in the West, you can see the Dhamma just painted on the signs wherever you go. Stop. So, this little novice stopped. Stop trying, stop doing, stop thinking, stop the past, stop everything, stop complaining, he just stopped. And after he stopped, he went really deep inside and just had an amazing experience. But the most important thing, the reason I tell that story, at the end of every talk, there's always, well, Ajahn Chah never do sadhu, 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 but he did do sadhu, and they bowed and did some chanting before they left and they banged the gong. He never heard any of that. Because this is what happens in the deep meditations. Sound is gone. Feeling is gone. So the five senses have vanished. Now what happens when the five senses first vanish? If they vanish a bit too quickly and you don't follow the instructions, your mindfulness is so, well, it's still pretty good, but it's not sharp enough that you can't see what's left when the five senses have gone. It is like going out from a brightly lit room into the darkness in the forest, and you can't see because your eyes haven't accommodated yet to the more subtle light. So number one, you can just wait for a while in the darkness. You're aware of something. You're not unconscious when the five senses have gone. What are you aware of? Just be with that. Don't choose. Don't ask, where's the nimittas? I want the nimittas. Just whatever you're watching, just be with. But the main reason is because the mindfulness is not strong enough yet to see those nimittas. How do you know the mindfulness is strong enough? Because it's accompanied with joy. Piti sukha. I mentioned this earlier, is an important part of meditation. If the joy is up there when you are meditating, that's a sign the mindfulness is strong. That's one of the best indicators you have really good mindfulness. Because what you see is beautiful and delightful. Which is one of the reasons why we develop that happiness with the breath. Breathing in, we experience pity, joy and happiness. Breathing out, we experience joy and happiness. We develop that. And we cultivate it. We cultivate it during the day. Smiling at one another. Laughing when somebody does something stupid. Enjoying just the beautiful weather. Going for a walk and seeing a kangaroo and patting it. That gives you a lot of joy and happiness. Cultivate that. Well, if you cultivate joy during the day, you know, even just when you do your breakfast, mess around with the breakfast. For example, the other day, not the lunch, somebody gave us some soup for lunch, and also Dira Yupa, she made these little jellies. So you have to have a jelly. So I said, okay, and I put the jelly in the soup. Just for messing around. Didn't really matter, you know, it tasted okay, just jelly and soup. Give it a try, fusion it's called these days in modern cafes. And that made you laugh, it made me laugh, it just having a bit of fun, you know, when you are actually in this retreat. That cultivates joy, that cultivates happiness. So that when you're meditating, you just got that mind of like joy and happiness and fun. You are light-hearted. Inspiration does the same. So what we're doing there is developing a joyful heart, a joyful mind. So that when we're actually watching the breath, that joy is still there for us. And you can watch the breath, oh, it's so nice. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, give me more of this. Wow, I can take this. Wow. Get into it. Many of you have met Ajahn Gunha. Mahinda, you went to see him the other day, didn't you? Very good. Really great monk. You try and get some teachings out of him. It's so difficult. That I was supposed to, was it last year, just over a year ago, went to Korea. They wanted to get meditation master conference in Korea. So they asked, can you get somebody from Thailand? I thought, oh crikey, who can I get? I thought, Ajahn Gunha. It was so difficult for me to, to persuade him to go to Korea. You know, I really just, moved everything to get him to go there. And when he went there, they were questioning him about meditation. And he would listen to the question. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you answer it. Another question. Ajahn Brahm, you answer it. And because he's senior to me and the way I've been trained, that's what he says. I have to do it. Got no choice. So it's a bit of a waste of time inviting him there. But not really, because he's a very nice character anyway. But you try and get some Dhamma teachings out of him. And the only Dhamma teaching on meditation I've ever heard from him in all the years I've known this monk, he's a monk who pats cobras, by the way. This is not just kangaroos. Kangaroos are easy to pat. The king cobras, that was that monk. And anyway, it's in the book, Open the Door of Your Heart. But that monk, the only thing he'd ever say about meditation was, breathe in, sabah. Breathe out, sabah. And you've got to hand it to him. That was an incredibly powerful meditation teaching. Sabah means just really nice and easy and comfortable and gentle and I don't know, what else can you say about sabai? I mean, it's really easy. And that's what he taught. Just breathe in, sabai. Oh, yeah. As sabai as you possibly can make it. Really get into it. Put some effort into breathing in without effort. Oh. And that's what he was doing, creating the happiness of the mind with your breathing. Remember that, because every now and again you can give that a go. And it's marvelous, it works. Because when it's beautiful and joyful, it's so easy to watch, and you're bringing that happiness in, the mindfulness is increasing. And so when the breath actually does get calm, simply because you don't need much oxygen, bodily you are still, and the brain is not struggling and striving and thinking and making strategies. So I know many people said the brain, that has first choice of the energy. Everything goes to the brain first, and whatever's left goes to the body. It's amazing just how much energy the brain actually takes up. So when your brain is not thinking at all, it's amazing just how much energy you don't need. Which means that you don't think so much, you don't actually waste so much energy. That's another problem for me. Because I hardly think at all. I don't eat that much. All the food which I get is not used in the brain. Because I don't worry enough. So it all goes in here. Not because I overeat. Because what I eat, I don't use. You guys, you're worrying about this, thinking about that, doing so much stuff that you can eat heaps. And it all gets metabolized in your brain because you think too much and worry too much. If I need to lose weight, then I need to worry some more. You have to teach me how to think some more. But of course, I don't want to do that. But also, Ajahn Gunha, is he happy, monk, Mahinda? And is he fat? Yes, another one. which proves my point. Happy fat monks, they're the best, they're the core. But he is. Ajahn Chah was the same. So anyway, I just walk in the lineage of my teachers. But I do have to worry sometimes because... it was Chinese New Year at Nola Mara Temple. I was talking to somebody in the reception area, standing up, about to go out. And of course, if it can happen, it does happen. This Chinese woman came in, took one look at me, it was Chinese New Year, and rubbed my belly for good luck. It's good luck, you know, like the fat Buddha. So I was laughing. I couldn't stop. I just felt it was so funny. Another anecdote. Having my body rub for good luck. So when I was in Hong Kong, we actually went to visit Macau. We thought, well, why don't you just go and stand outside one of the casinos? We can raise some money, just, you know, $20 a rub. I could have made a fortune for the nuns' monastery. But anyway, where was I going? I should be serious. Yeah, about nimittas. So when the five senses vanish, and you've got happiness and joy in the mind, your mindfulness is so strong that is when you start seeing the beautiful lights come up. Now those lights, they just know sometimes the weakest nimittas, sometimes is a firework nimittas, whoosh, and then they disappear after a few seconds. Ping pong nimittas, they come, they go, and then they come again, like tennis, table tennis balls. You have the complicated nimittas, like a movie, and see people and things and streams and whatever it is, mountains, all sorts of nimittas. They're all nimittas because this is the mind doing its thing. Nothing to do. You're not seeing it with the eyes. You're seeing it with the mind. And a lot of times, you can't hear things, you can't feel your body, it's just five senses gone. Those complicated nimittas, they're just because you've got a complicated mind right now. And simplify it and the nimittas get more and more simple, more and more pure. So, an example of this from personal experience, if you do have a complicated nimitta, like I remember the time when I was seeing these beautiful green fields and nice trees and a river. I think this was during the summertime in Australia where it was dry and brown. And so seeing beautiful green fields and streams and little birdies flying through the trees. That's complicated. Very nice, but complicated. But I have enough understanding of these things to know what to do. Just start to look for the most beautiful part of that scenery, the simple part. Something which is sparkling, twinkling. And for me, I remember that experience. It was just zooming in on one of the trees, on the leaf of that tree, on the little dewdrop on the tip of the leaf, which was sparkling in the sunshine. And as soon as you zoom in, phew, and that became a full-fledged nimitta. So that's actually what you do. If you see complicated ones, look for the nice sparkle somewhere. There's always a sparkle there somewhere. And then that becomes this brilliant nimitta, like a star, like a sun. So that's what you do with complicated nimittas. For those nimittas which come and go and come and go, why do they come and why do they go? They come because you are still, they go because you tried to capture them. And it's just like that story I said about the Anagarika with the emu. You go chasing the emus in the forest, they run away from you, but you sit down and do nothing and the emu comes to you. But the best simile, you may have heard it before, the one which really helped me being able to get nimittas and to have them really stable and still was good old Ajahn Chah's still forest pool simile. And I could relate to this because when I was a young monk, I could go on these, they called it Tudong, on Charika, and there was some jungle left in those days. But there's no jungle left now, unfortunately, except maybe in the borders, but even there it's not the same as it used to be. But, you know, it's part of your training, your learning, what to do when you're on this Tudong, this wandering, staying in the forest. One thing you had to do, if you wanted to have a meal, you check in at the local village first of all, and they would often tell you where you can find some nice forest to stay in. But it was mostly so the village would know that you were in the vicinity and you'd go there the following morning for alms food and get something to eat. If they didn't know you were coming, sometimes they weren't prepared and you may just get a little bit of rice and nothing else. So that was what you had to do. And also, usually in the jungle, to find a place near to a river, a lake, so that you had a place to wash. Because if you're walking all day through the jungle, you get very dirty and sweaty. And it means that, you need to wash your body first of all, and then wash some robes as well. And lastly, to fill up your little canteen with some water. You filter it, and that would be your drinking. So just basic survival. And once you've had your wash and your bathe, and rinsed out a few robes, then you pull up your mosquito net. You used to have these mosquito nets when we went traveling. On an umbrella, about 10, 20, 30 meters at most from the water's edge, to stay the night. And that's what Ajahn Chah used to do. And when you were in your mosquito net, sometimes he would keep his eyes open at night, especially a full moon night, because then in the evening, you see all the animals come out to play and drink. They wanted a drink as well. And these were the days before Nature Channel, National Geographic. So he could sit there and be entertained by the antics, the amazing behavior of the animals in the wild. And my story about that, which I don't mind sharing many, many times, was I wasn't on wandering around. I was staying in a remote hermitage way up in the middle of in the mountains north of Chiang Mai. I was the only monk there, and I asked the head man, why aren't there more monks here? And they said, the monks say it's too quiet for them. And I thought, wow, this is the place for me. It's idyllic. And hot season, I'd put a little basin out with water for the birds. It's incredible how quickly the birds find out there's water there. And I'd watch them in the afternoon through a knot hole in the wooden boards of the hut. So they couldn't see me. They didn't know I was watching. And it was delightful to watch their antics because this was Thailand. They couldn't have been Thai birds. They couldn't have been Thai birds because they all stood in line in a queue. It's true. I was in Thailand 9 years. You don't find people standing in queues in Thailand. But the birds did, and all different species. Big ones, small ones. The one who got there first was in front, and then the next one came, stood behind. Then the next one is about a dozen birds in a queue. Never seen the light before. So cute. And then the first bird on top would go in the water, seeing them, they'd drink and they'd wash and flap their wings and stuff like that. And then they'd fly out and the next one would go in. They're so organized. But then what would happen? They would always, every afternoon, there'd be one bird would come in and jump the queue. And that was the fun part. Because as soon as it jumped the queue and tried to, get in the water before everyone else, all the other birds would get out of queue, jump on that bird, peck him, beat him up, and then that bird would fly away, and then they'd all go back in the queue exactly where they were before. And that was incredible, that they could organize themselves. Totally different species. How they did that, I don't know. But they could teach a lot to the human beings. That's what happens when you see animals in the wild. They're so cute and so fun. And far more intelligent than people think. So there they were. Ajahn Chah would do that. But he said they would only come out to play by the pool when he was quiet, when he was still. Because if he made a noise, if he moved, those animals would be sniffing. They couldn't see very well, but they'd sniff. And if they could sniff there was a human being around, they'd be terrified. More tigers have been killed by humans than humans have been killed by tigers. So imagine, if you saw a tiger, would you be afraid? Imagine how tigers feel, sniffing a human. They're terrified, just as all other animals are. So if the animals know there's a human being there, even though they're thirsty and dirty, they won't come out of the forest, they stay there. They go thirsty because at least they wouldn't be killed. That is why Ajahn Chah had to be so still. The animals never knew he was there. They sniffed, they'd look, and they could not detect him. And that's when they came out to play. And that became the simile of the nimittas. Nimittas are like the jungle animals who are coming out to play by your still mind, the still forest pool. But they'd only come out to play if you are so still that those nimittas, they don't think there's anybody watching them. If you watch and if you move, yes, nimitta, they'll hear that and they'll run away. If you get scared, oh, nimittas, they'll know that and they'll disappear and they won't come out. So you have to be like a monk, a nun, forest monk, so still that when these nimittas come out, they don't realize that someone's watching. And then he continued the story, which was a beautiful part. He said very often he'd sit so still and animals would come out to play, but sometimes he'd be so still that some animals would come out to play. And they were so incredibly beautiful and rare that no, not even his parents or his teachers had ever told him such animals existed. They were really shy. They'd only come out to play when he was perfectly still, when he didn't move. Those were the jhanas. They're just hanging in the bush, in the forest, waiting to come out to drink. But you have to be so still. They don't know you're watching. It's a beautiful simile. Because every time that nimitta started coming up, I imagine I was Ajahn Chah. Be still. Don't move. Shh. Don't say anything. Shh. Nimittas are coming. And that's how they would come. And that's how they would stay. You can give much advice, but images like that are so very helpful. Now, in the nimittas, they would come and stay for a while, but sometimes they were just moving around too much. Moving up here. First of all, it's so common, I've got to say this. Sometimes a nimitta appears and it's not in the center, it's up there somewhere, the top left or the top right nimittas. And so what stupid people do, they go looking up there for it. And of course it disappears. It's like it's testing you out. So just wait, just keep your eyes on the center. You can see it in the corner of your eye. It's just saying, you know, is she ready for me? And if you just say, okay, come, if you can go if you want. You can stay up there all my life, I don't care. And then it will center itself. Never go chasing a nimitta. You'll chase it away. But sometimes, for me, this time was moving, and it couldn't be still. If it wasn't, it was always there, but not still. Sometimes, I never had this, but sometimes people have the nimittas spiraling all around the place. And that is because you are not still. You're, you know, reasonably still, so the nimitta stays there, but not still enough that it becomes still. And the insight which I got, you know, messing around with nimittas and wondering what could I do next, shaving in the morning. Remember this experience, shaving my beard. And I noticed that this image of myself in the mirror was also moving. And I think just to prove it to myself, I held the mirror still, but because I was moving, the image also moved. If you want the nimitta to be still, it's a waste of time holding the mind still. That's just like holding a mirror still. The one who is watching has to be still. So that's what I did. You know, I imagined, got the perceptual framework, the way of looking, of I'm looking at the nimitta, it's a reflection of the one who's looking. So if I want the nimitta to be still, I have to be still. So the one who's looking froze, and the nimitta froze as well. Very lovely way of just getting them to be perfectly still. So once you get a still nimitta, not complicated anymore, then it starts to build up its power. Stillness creates more energy, and it gets really powerful, really beautiful, really powerful. And this is where people come in interviews. I'm trying to get less interviews, so ask, you know, get the questions answered first before you write them down. And people say, oh, sometimes the nimitta is so bright, I will go blind. That's why I have to wear glasses. No, it's not, I'm joking, this old age. No, it's not seeing it with your eyes, you're seeing it with your mind. It's a mental image, it can be bright as it wants. And sometimes it's like that. You know, you feel you're staring directly into the sun. It's so brilliant and so bright. And I've had that, I thought, oh, better stop this, I'm going to go blind. And they're absolutely stupid. And he goes, hang on, your eyes are closed, you're not seeing this. It's a mental image. And so that once you realize that, oh, just carry on, bright as you want, I'm never going to go blind. Because other people have that experience too. So to avoid you having said that, you just carry on, you don't go blind. Totally, 100% guaranteed. All your money back. But you won't be able to see, so I can give you anything and you won't know it's money or if it's just pieces of paper. But anyway, no, you don't go blind. But it gets very intense. Very intense experience. It's supposed to be intense. Incredible happiness, joy, bliss. And if it's a light, incredible light. Why lights? And the reason is, again, you investigated this, why do these nimittas usually appear as lights? And the point is that we're mostly visual beings. Of all those five senses, most of the brain is taken up with sight, seeing things. We recognize each other not by how we smell, that's how dogs recognize you. You know, we look at each other, I know who you are now by sight. Even the sound of your voice, yes, you can have voice recognition, but we don't really use that. We know each other by how we look. We are very visual beings, our surroundings by sight. And so because the dominant sense of human beings is usually seeing, that is why this mental image, which comes up in deep meditation, is interpreted, is perceived as a light. It is not a light. You are not seeing this with your eyes. It is a mental experience, but the only way we make sense of it is as a light. Now, the next thing is, well, can you have other nimittas? Yes, you can, but it's not as clear and it is not as sure. The common way is using these lights. And if you go the normal way, not, instead of trying to find shortcuts, you don't waste so much time. So develop the perception of the light in these nimittas. And to show you how common they are, every one of you in this room will see a nimitta sooner or later. You will see this incredible, beautiful light. If not now, when you die. When you die, people who have near-death experience, what do? Their five senses shut down and they go towards the light. That is exactly the same as the nimitta you see in meditation. Because the five senses have gone when you die, The only thing you can see now is your mind, your citta. That's what people do when they die. They go to the mind. Now, if you can absorb into that mind, if you go right inside that nimitta, just like, I forget the lady's name, she was some Singaporean, Muralese or Mulloyles, or whatever. Anyway, she wrote a book about it. And interestingly, it's amazing just how coincidence happened. Her doctor is the local doctor at Serpentine. He was the one who was looking after this girl, who wrote this best-selling book about going into this light. And she described it, if you read that book, pure love, she said. 100% just acceptance, love, peace, bliss. So that's jhana-like. What I found really interesting there is bliss, pleasure, happiness. How do we describe it? And the way she described it is the purest of love. Not sort of attached love, but just total acceptance as being. And that's actually a fascinating description of the bliss, the piti sukha. Not just pleasure, which is describing it as like a physical, through the physical sense, but something a bit more refined. This is where ecstasy, bliss and love all come together and you can't distinguish between any of them. So anyway, you're going to get that. But it's better to do it before you die, so you can tell everyone else about it. No, not because you can tell. So you can actually make better use of it. So this is what happens. Five senses go, beautiful light comes up. In the Upakalesa Sutta, the Buddha kept on saying, be careful of two things. These are the two big problems. Fear and excitement. Those are the two big ones. Because, you'd love it if a powerful nimitta came, wouldn't you? You know, if I could give you something and just touch your head or give some spell or charm and you're going to get a nimitta, oh yeah, we'll have that. But when it really comes, it's huge. And if you're a control freak, even a small control freak, you know you can't control this thing. It's way bigger than you, way more powerful. And that scares the hell out of you. You can't control this. It's too big, too powerful. Which is one of the reasons why if you don't learn how to let go now on small things, when big things come up, you won't be able to let go at all. You'd want to manipulate it, and when you realize you can't, oh no, I don't know how to deal with this. And you'll have fear, and it will disappear. You'll kill it, basically. So this is one of the reasons why you don't control these things. Just let them be. Perfectly safe. Huge energy, huge power. Imagine you met a huge tiger in this forest. You know, that they can eat you up. They're so powerful. You can't control them. You can't fight the tiger. So what would you do? Just let it be. So that means that you have to have this incredible courage, otherwise known as virya. Ability to let things go, to abandon everything for the sake of something which is really worthwhile. The truth, jhanas, nibbana, to be able to let go of so much. Okay, I don't mind telling this little story. I think I told it again. I've got to be really careful that, you know, I don't make claims. But it's like when you're on the edge of jhanas, powerful nimittas. And the metaphor was that, you know, the door's open. You can go into that jhana if you wish. It's so easy, but so scary. It's really powerful. But you look through and it's so much bliss, so much profound experience, but it's just too much for me. But it looks so enticing. But I can't. But why not? But it's too much. I'm scared. It's so wonderful. What the heck? I'm going. That's basically what happens sometimes. You're scared as anything sometimes because it's really powerful. Even though you read about this in the suttas, you know, you realize that this is a real big stuff from a Buddhist, and you're supposed to do this, the Buddha recommended it, you know, your teachers recommend it, encourage you, but when you come up right in front of it, can you accept it? Ooh, maybe next lifetime, not now. A bit too much for me. There is fear there. If you control. If you can let go, really let go. Abandon everything. You're abandoning yourself, basically. You're letting go of your attachment to this thing which you claim to be yourself. If you can let that go, then you can get into these nimittas and jhanas really easily. So it's the fear. And of course the other one is the excitement. And that comes out when you feel these are attainments. Yay! I have got a nimitta. There's no I there. If you get excited, it means you're trying to own these things. Yay, I won the lottery. The Jhana Grove lottery. I got nimittas. Woohoo! So be careful of excitement and fear, because they destroy your serenity. So these things, they don't come up. But once they do come up, there's another thing quickly about the nimittas. Because I've been teaching these a long time. And I also say that sometimes people say, yeah, they see these nimittas. They see it's light, but it's not bright. It's like dirty. It's like stained. And so I gave a talk about that once in KL. And I said, well, you know, what that actually is, your precepts, you know, your goodness, your virtue is stained. Because what you're actually seeing, the nimitta, is a reflection of your mind. If you've got a pure mind, that nimitta is pure. If you've been naughty, not keeping the rules, then when that nimitta comes up, it will be dirty. That's what it looks like. I always remember this. He was my attendant when I was in Kuala Lumpur. When he came up, he wanted to talk to me desperately. He said, I got a nimitta. And it was like a dirty, oily rag which has been used to clean up everything. I said, yeah, well, what you've been doing? He said, yeah, that's the point. I apologize, Ajahn Brahm. But you can't hide this. You know, it's yourself. You know, not yourself, but your mind. You see it. And you can't sort of avoid it. But that's also the reason why, if you really are kind, you really forgive one another. You made a mistake. I let it go. Forgive. Be compassionate. The last piece of toast, give to someone else. Don't keep it for yourself. You're really generous. You put so many donations in the donation box because, it's a wonderful thing to support. And you're always compassionate and good. You see a rule, you don't really understand why we should keep these rules, but okay, Ajahn Brahm said so, we'll do it. Really pure-hearted people. And these are the persons who they're always willing to help you. You know, we call it pure-hearted people. You know what I'm talking about, pure-hearted. And if you're one of those, a really pure heart, never say a bird word to anybody. Always, you know, you see people arguing, trying to calm them down. Someone who's just out there, just everyone else has gone home and you're cleaning the toilets. It's not your job, but you just do it because it needs to be done. Really, you know, good people. And you all know what I'm talking about. Those people, when they get to nimittas, wow. Their nimitta is absolutely gorgeous. So it just comes out, and wow. The amount of pity sukha they get is huge. So they get into jhanas easy because of the purity. And I always wondered why, what virtue has to do with meditation? Why do you have to keep precepts and be compassionate and be generous and be good and be forgiving? Why virtue? Can't bad guys and girls get into jhanas if they know all the tricks? And this is where you find that the payoff, all those virtuous stuff you've done, the real goodness, the kindness, you know, just in the middle of the retreat and you get a message that, you know, your mother's sick. And you're really getting into the meditation, but no, okay, it's my mum. I've got to go and see her. Those people, you think, they'll never get jhanas. They go and look after their mother who's sick. And in the afternoon, evening, they have half an hour meditate. Wham, bam. Nimitta comes straight away. Because they're really pure, good people. Their mind is powerful. Empowered with the beauty and energy of goodness. So if you have dirty nimittas or weak nimittas, they're not very powerful. Check your virtue, your precepts, your goodness. And if you can do that, you find, ooh, nimittas come out there. They blow your mind. You deserve it. Because that's you. You've earned that. However, for the rest of you, the trick, the loophole, which is what I told this guy, who's had really stained, dirty nimittas. Yes, the first time a nimitta comes up, it's weak, it's not powerful, and it's got stain here and stain there. Oh yeah, I know what that one was. Don't look at the dirty parts. Look at the most beautiful part. There's always the most beautiful part, just the nice part of the nimitta. Hey, look at that nimitta, and you zoom in on that. So all the beautiful part just fills up your mind, and the dirty parts and the stains, they all just go off the screen. And then you got, it's no stains, but it's not bright yet. In there, find out the brightest part of it, and zoom in on the brightest part of it. And zoom in on the most beautiful part of the brightest part, and keep zooming into the nice stuff. And soon you get this incredible, powerful, beautiful nimitta. You're focusing on that part of your citta which is beautiful. Yeah, you may not be saints, but you do saintly things every now and again. Maybe not as often as you would like, but you do it sometimes. If you zoom in on that, you get powerful nimittas, and then you can go really deep inside. So that's what happens with nimittas. If you haven't got one yet, don't worry about it. It will come. Just be still. They're waiting in the forest there, waiting to come out as soon as you are still enough and peaceful enough. And the five senses start to vanish. Before you ask another question later on this evening, the five senses don't need to totally vanish to get a nimitta. The simile is, this is the strength of your five senses. This is the strength of the sixth sense of mind. The five senses are usually so dominant. But in this retreat, when you start to suppress the five senses, called sense restraint, suppress the five senses, calm them down, calm them down. Don't talk so much. Don't go looking around everywhere. Nature is okay because that calms you down. But don't look at people. And that calms you down. And at the same time, your mind is getting more and more energy. And it comes to the time, the five senses haven't dropped off yet. They haven't stopped, but they're so weak. And your mind, your jitta, is so powerful that it dominates. And you can see the nimitta, even though you can hear things. When it gets really strong, this is weird, but it happens. Even though I had a few jhanas, really, really strong meditation, then that nimitta is up there almost all the time. So you have to eat your meal through the light. Weird, but that's true, because the citta is so strong, it's almost dominating, even though the five senses are still active. So you don't have to totally abandon the five senses. Really subdue them, empower the mind. When the mind is stronger than the five senses, then you see nimittas. And that's your job. See what happens. Sadhu. 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 Okay, I've got a full board of interviews this morning. So please be on time and please keep under the 10 minutes.